Hello, you're listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Dave Chancellor. In this, our March 2016 podcast, we'll be talking with Susanna Comic-Tock about what she calls the tax war on poverty. Comic-Tock is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and an IRP affiliate. When I sat down with Professor Comic-Tock for this interview, I first asked her what she means by the tax war on poverty.
A lot of anti-poverty programs at the federal level in today's day and age take the form of provisions in the tax code, and that's the phenomenon that I am studying with my project. We can think of these tax code provisions as falling into two rough categories. Some are what I call, for want of a better term, demand-side programs. They provide direct cash subsidies to low-income folks, often through the middle class, so often low to middle-income folks, either direct income support, that would be the earned income tax credit, or the child tax credit, might be for something specific like education or healthcare. So those provide money, get money into the hands of folks who might be experiencing poverty. The other type of program takes the form of what I call sometimes the supply side programs. They create incentives for third parties to provide services for or resources for folks experiencing poverty. One of the best known of those programs is the low-income housing credit, providing a subsidy to developers who build low-income housing. One that we don't think of as much, but certainly falls into that category, is the set of benefits for tax-exempt organizations, private charities that provide services for individuals experiencing poverty. So it's a whole range of programs falling into those two categories.
Comic-Tock explains that the number and generosity of tax code-based anti-poverty programs has grown significantly over the years. This is in contrast to what's happened to direct spending programs.
The first major program here is the one most people know the most about, the earned income tax credit that came in as a temporary provision in the early 70s. Has had a consistent history of expansion since then up until this December when expansions to the EITC were made permanent as part of the budget bill that passed both houses of Congress. So in that period, we've seen a lot more of these tax credits popping up. You see some in the 80s, you see a big glut in the 90s, and we're continuing to see them proposed today. For example, Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign has proposed a number of tax programs that would have some effect on low-income folks. So it's a creature of the past however long it's been since the 70s, and it's a phenomenon that's continuing to become bigger and bigger all the time. While at the same time, we see reductions in direct spending programs. So, for example, direct welfare, TANF, food stamps, those types of things. We don't see new programs along those lines. We don't see as many of them, and the dollar figures involved in those programs are shrinking relative to the growth in the tax programs in dollar terms.
Professor Comic-Tock says that part of the reason for this shift away from direct spending programs and toward tax-based programs can be attributed to what she refers to as the public opinion advantages that come with tax-based programs.
People have expressed in polls that they prefer programs that are structured as tax provisions to programs that are structured as direct spending programs. Political scientists and other researchers, including myself, have done experiments in which we describe to respondents two programs, and one group of individuals will get a description of a direct spending program, a direct subsidy, $500 for adopting a child, buying food. And then another group of respondents will get a description of a tax program, same size, aimed at the same goal. And over again, across different areas, we found that people prefer the tax programs. There are a bunch of hypotheses for why that might be true. We don't know. There's nothing in the literature right now that tells us. So one of my current projects, and I'm co-authoring this with my husband in the political science department, we have a survey running right now where we try to get to the bottom of this preference. Why does something become dramatically more popular when you call it a tax credit or a tax deduction? Why might that be?
Comic Talk says that in addition to these tax-based programs just being more popular, they also see much more bipartisan support.
So, for example, when you look at the budget bill that passed just before Christmas, you see this big permanent EITC and child credit expansion passing two Republican-controlled houses of Congress. It's a plan that President Obama's administration has promoted and advocated for, but it's passing the Republican-led houses of Congress. You know, this is a set of expansions that the head of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, so pro-welfare, pro-poverty spending organization, says it's one of the greatest anti-poverty accomplishments, this budget bill, in the past 10 years, putting aside maybe Obamacare. And that's something that, again, you see Republicans and Democrats working together on it. Another example is a lot of folks talk about the Grover Norquist's anti-tax activism and how that's pushed the Republican Party to the right. As part of that, a number of members of Congress, mostly Republicans, have signed a pledge where they say they will not cut any tax credit or deduction or exclusion. So what that means is that all these members of Congress have pledged that they will not do anything to hurt the earned income tax credit or the new markets tax credit or any of these things. So there's a lot of bipartisan support. And again, we can, as researchers, try to speculate and then do more than speculate, trying to figure out why these programs might be so popular.
There are also some process-oriented reasons that may contribute to the establishment and growth of tax-based programs, including, for example, the congressional committee structure and provisions for automatic program growth, depending on demand. In addition, Comic Talk says that it's often cheaper and easier to roll out a new program through the tax code than it is to set up a new direct spending program. However, establishing anti-poverty programs through the tax code has some downsides, one of which is that they're not as likely to reach Americans in deep poverty.
Most of these programs on the demand side have a work requirement or have a minimum level of income you have to get them. If you don't have a job or don't have any income, you're not going to be able to get one of these programs. Or, for example, the design of the low-income housing credit, which allows developers to collect some percent of residents' income as rent, you know, they want to find higher income poor folks to rent to, and the credit's set up so as to allow that or to encourage that. Same thing, new markets tax credit, going to give you an incentive to build a store in a poor community. If you don't have any money and you're not buying a lot from that store, it's just not going to help you much. The major exception is the exemption for charities dealing with poverty, but we know that the charities dealing with poverty are just a small subset of the charities that are getting the tax exemption and getting the deductible contributions. So I've debated in a number of different settings, and I don't have an answer, whether it would be possible to imagine tax programs that could serve the deeply poor. But right now, we don't have those.
Comic Talk says that another disadvantage to administering anti-poverty programs through the tax code is that there's not much of a support infrastructure when people need help resolving an issue with a benefit or a payment.
So for example, we know right now that if you receive the earned income tax credit, you're more likely to get audited. You get audited in the form, most often, in the form of a correspondence audit. The IRS freezes your refund, sends you a letter saying, you have a problem with your EITC, respond to this letter and tell us why, you know, and tell us what the issue is and respond to our allegations that you claimed it wrong. Well, the majority of those letters we know just go unanswered. People get these letters, they don't know what to do, they don't know how to fix the problem, they don't know where to go. Whereas with traditional welfare, food stamps, first of all, there might be an agency where you can go. And second, legal aid offices, poverty lawyers have government benefits wings that are set up to help you out. Not that that's always sufficient, it certainly isn't, but that infrastructure is there more than it is with the tax programs. And Congress is working that on that through grants to develop low-income taxpayer assistance clinics, but these are relatively new, still getting their feet on the ground, whereas legal aid offices have been helping folks dispute their welfare benefits for a long time.
The lack of a strong support infrastructure within the IRS when it comes to anti-poverty programs isn't particularly surprising to Comic Talk, who says that the IRS readily agrees that it doesn't have the capacity to administer so many of these kinds of programs.
The IRS itself has complained that it doesn't have experience administering these programs. It's being given too many programs to administer and not enough money with which to administer them. So the taxpayer advocate is like an IRS ombudsman figure. And every year she comes out in her report, and she almost every year, and says, the EITC is just too big a program for us. We can't catch all the fraud. We don't know what to do. People have questions. We can't answer them. We're not set up to deal with this. Now, we don't know how the IRS's experience administering these programs is different from how the other agencies do. I mean, they probably report problems of their own, but we definitely know that the IRS is getting a lot, Congress is putting a lot on its plate these days.
One of the key takeaways from Comic Talk's work in this area is that it's clear that we have entered a new era in the delivery of social benefits, one that's focused on the delivery of anti-poverty programs through the tax code and away from direct spending programs, even if the infrastructure to support and evaluate such a shift hasn't been fully developed.
These programs are different than the direct spending programs that came before them. They have different politics. They're administered differently. They raise different sets of problems. And we have to start thinking about what the consequences of those differences are. One thing I talk about a bit in the paper is that these programs don't come with any kind of formal evaluation mechanism. So we don't really know how well these programs are doing, if people are having a good or bad experience in administering them. What's it like for a lawyer who, at a low-income taxpayer assistance clinic, who's representing poor taxpayers with regard to these benefits? What problems are they facing? We just are at the very beginning of exploring how these programs are different and the particular issues that they raise. And I'm looking forward to continuing to do it in the years to come as I work on this project.
Many thanks to Susanna Comic Talk for this interview. For more on this work, check out her 2014 article on the tax war on poverty in the Arizona Law Review. You've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty.